I was asked to bring a lesson on missions, and that's been changed, but I did prepare that lesson, and it was going to be from Acts chapter 9, verses 15 and 16, and this is the commissioning ceremony of Paul, the archetypal missionary, written and planned by God Himself and conducted by Brother Ananias of the First Christian Church of Damascus. And reading verses 15 and 16, the Lord said to Ananias, "Go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel. For I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake." And I wanted to look at God's perspective on missions from these two verses and God's description of three things that give us an idea of how He looks at the whole missionary enterprise. The first point was going to be God's view of the man. The second point, His view of the mission. And the third point, His view of the remuneration. So you have the man, the mission, the remuneration. God's description of the man, a chosen instrument of mine. And then God's description of the mission, to bear my name before the Gentiles. God's description of the remuneration, how much he must suffer for my name's sake. And I wanted to delve into that and just look at how God's perspective is often so different from our own. And we see that in the very description of the man, the mission, and the remuneration. But last night I didn't get through the presentation on what the Lord has been doing in Mozambique through the ministry that He's let us be a part of. I didn't get to the third point over the last 3 years. So what we're going to do is we're going to do that. I also didn't show the slides, so we're going to do that. And then I know I'll have some time left over, so I brought the missionary stories. And I would say about these missionary stories, they're all being loaded onto our website. And it'll be about 2 weeks before we get all the stories up there. But if you're interested in knowing more about these stories, you can log on to gracemissionsministries.org, gracemissionsministries.org, and then you can click on the Answers to Prayer page, and we've got a bunch of stories about how God has answered prayer. Or you can click on the Favorite Stories page, and you'll hear just favorite stories. Or you can click on God's Hand at Work page, and you'll get to read stories. We've got about 40 stories, and we'll have all the newsletters on there eventually, but we'll put about 40 stories there, so you can see how the Lord has been involved in this ministry from the beginning. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to finish my last point of what the Lord has been doing in Mozambique, and then tell some of these stories and show the slides. Now, with regard to the ministry that the Lord has let us be involved in, if you were here last night, you learned that during our first term we were involved almost exclusively in medical evangelistic work. In the second term, the Lord gave us the opportunity to become involved in church planting as a church was established in Nampula, that we sought to pattern according to the Bible. And then in the third term, which I didn't get to speak about, the Lord opened up an opportunity for us to have a ministry. By the way, if there's no need for that picture to be on the wall the whole time. Whoever knows how to turn the machine off, if you want, turn it off, and I will get going with that at the end of the presentation. But in the third term, the Lord gave us the opportunity to become involved in a ministry to the entire nation of Mozambique through a Christian literature distribution program. Free books are sent out, one book every month, to pastors and church workers who are registered on the program for 36 months. And this gives them a very nice pastor's library. This is very important in a country like Mozambique where there are no Christian bookstores. Now, recently, a Christian bookstore was opened up in Maputo, the capital, 1,000 miles from where we are. And as you'll hear at the end of this presentation, the Lord has enabled us to open up a Christian bookstore in Nampula. Those are the only two places I know of where Christian books are available in the country of Mozambique, and that's only been recently. So we had this Christian literature distribution program going on for the pastors. And then in connection with that also is an annual pastors' conference which has been attended by up to 160 pastors and church workers. They come from 8 of Mozambique's 10 provinces, and they represent over 40 different denominations and church groups. And so that's being conducted in Nampula. So we've been very thankful for the opportunity to be involved in that. Now, the way that came about, it's in connection with an excellent Brazilian ministry that's been conducted by Brother Richard Denham. He's a Reformed Baptist missionary working in Brazil for 50 years. And for the last 30 years, he's been publishing titles of excellent books. If you're familiar with the Banner of Truth Trust, basically it's these excellent books that have been, they're Puritan classics, they're written by the ancient Reformation fathers, as well as modern authors who write in the same theme. They translate a lot of the books of R.C. Sproul and John MacArthur. They translate them into Portuguese, and then they distribute them throughout the Portuguese-speaking world. And over the 30 years, they've been missionaries there for 50 years, but they've been in the publishing business for 30 years, they've translated 130 titles, and every one of them is a gem. And in addition to that, they distribute a quarterly magazine that's particularly oriented for pastors and church workers. And for the past 20 years in Brazil, they've held an annual pastors' conference. And the purpose of these conferences is to encourage and refresh the pastors. They can come. There's no politics involved. It's not like church meetings. It's just a time when they can be refreshed from the Word of God and have their own spirits restored and nurtured. And then the second purpose is to acquaint pastors with this rich legacy that's been left us by the Reformation fathers, and to provide books that they can purchase. In Mozambique, we sell the books for 1/6 of their regular cost at the conference. And, of course, if they're on the reading program, they get a book free every month. And then the third purpose is to acquaint them with the doctrines of grace. And that's especially important in Mozambique, where the churches have a very works-oriented view of salvation. There's not too much difference discernible between a Protestant church and a Catholic church, it seems, in that regard, as works are heavily emphasized as the means by which a person can be saved if he's good enough. And so we delight to have the opportunity to acquaint them with the doctrines of grace through these conferences. Well, before I went to Mozambique in 1990, I learned about Editora Fiel. That's Faithful Publishers. That's the publishing house in Brazil. And I ordered about $1,000 worth of books, and I brought them over with me, and we set up a lending library in the big bookcase in our living room. And so the pastors and the church workers began coming to our house in order to get these books. And when the church was established in the second term, we put in another order for $2,000 worth of books so that we could have them available, not only to available through the hospital, as you'll understand. If you were here last night, we used the hospital as a bookshop, mainly to sell Bibles. But we also had these books available there at the hospital, and in order to be available for the church. And so through this connection with Editora Fiel, in 1997, Richard Denham called me up from Brazil, and he said he wanted to expand this ministry that they had all through Brazil. He wanted to expand it into Mozambique and wanted to know if I could head that up. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to do it justice. I referred him to an excellent man in Maputo, a Reformed Baptist missionary named Carl Peterson. That's 1,000 miles away from Nampula, but I knew he could do it. And he just embraced that, and he's turned that into his most fulfilling ministry in Mozambique. But paradoxically, though the headquarters was down there in Maputo at that time, most of the pastors who got on the program right away were from Nampula, because, of course, I'd had this lending library that had been functioning for several years already. And so after a while, Carl Peterson said he wanted to come up to Nampula and spend a few weeks with me so that he could get to know all these pastors that he was ministering to through the book distribution program. And I suggested, well, why don't we try to get a conference going like they do in Brazil for these guys? And we figured there'd be about 10 or 15 pastors that would show up for this conference. And that one of the reasons I was emboldened to suggest that was because we had a good friend in Johannesburg. Every year our family takes a month's vacation in Johannesburg, and we go to the church of an excellent pastor there named Martin Holt. And he's an internationally known conference speaker. He's invited all over Europe, England, Canada, the United States, and throughout Africa as a conference speaker. And he comes right down the same line. as this literature that we were distributing. And he'd always said he wanted to get up to Nampula to visit our family. And I thought, well, if we can get him up here to visit us, we'll just sneak in this conference on the side and get him to be our conference speaker. And so we contacted him, and this was the first evidence that the Lord's hand was at work in this, because he agreed to come and to bring seven messages for these 10 to 15 pastors. And so then we wrote, or we contacted Editora Fiel in Brazil, and we said we'd like to have this Fiel conference like you guys have in Brazil in Mozambique. Is that okay with you? And they said, yeah, it's okay. Not only that, but we're going to send our founder, Richard Denham, out there to be at the conference. And immediately we said, oh, no, no, that's not a good idea. You know, it's only going to be 10 or 15 pastors, and this is our first conference, and we don't even know what we're doing. There are going to be lots of mistakes. Why don't you wait until it's built up steam and it's going well before you go to the expense of sending him out here? But they overruled us. They said, no, we want to be involved. And so they sent Richard Denham out. And when he came, he brought with him $4,000 worth of books, many, many, many crates and boxes that all made it all the way to Nampula as excess baggage. And of course, $4,000 worth of books, what a windfall that would have been for 10 to 15 pastors who had never seen more than three or four books on a shelf in their life, probably. Until they started getting these that were coming to them each month. But in fact, there weren't only 10 or 15 pastors. Apparently, the pastors were very impressed with these quarterly journals that were being distributed by Carl Peterson throughout the entire country. These are all coming from Brazil, from Editora Fiel. And when the notice went out that we were going to have a Fiel conference in Nampula, they began telling all of their friends. And 137 pastors signed up, and we were expecting only 10 to 15, so we were amazed, and I was filled with dread because I didn't know how we were possibly going to be able to handle that, our first shot out of the gate. Well, the Lord's hand was also evident when the meetings got underway.
Verse 9.
We brought a translator to translate the messages from English to Portuguese all the way up from Maputo, because he was highly recommended. And it turned out the man was not a preacher and had a hard time expressing even the things that were being communicated, and also could barely understand English. And the first message really flopped, and we wondered, what are we going to do? But by the grace of God, a seminary professor, he's one of the colleagues from Master Seminary. They've got a seminary in Petersburg, South Africa, and they were training in that seminary a Mozambican brother about 20 years old. Yeah, it was Jos Nixon and Tyler Hopkins. They had a fellow, a Mozambican fellow, that they were training, and they knew about this conference. And so at their own expense, they sent him to the conference so he could get to know these pastors and this ministry. And he was staying with us. And when this translator just totally failed, we turned to him and said, well, you know, you speak Portuguese, you speak English, you translate for us. And he was superb. It was the right man at the right place. And he was our translator for the next two conferences as well. And so we were so thankful for that. And then, just before the conference took place, I had to work in a quick trip to South Africa in order to get supplies, not only for the conference, but for a lot of other things. And quick trip is an oxymoron in Africa. There's no such thing as quick trip. It took us 10 days to get back from Maputo from Johannesburg to Nampula, and that was 4 days longer than I expected. And so we got back only 6 days. I expected to have 10 days to get this conference all organized. My responsibilities were all of the on-the-ground arrangements in Nampula. And so I only had 6 days, and I didn't know how we were going to do this. And particularly, I didn't know where we were going to find tables and chairs to feed 137 men in a city like Nampula, because they just don't exist. You don't have caterers, you don't have rental places, and people don't even have chairs and so forth. And I thought, how are we going to do this? And I showed up at the meeting hall 2 days before the conference to start getting things set up, and I didn't have a clue what we were going to do. And lo and behold, the night before, one of the wealthiest families in Nampula had a big wedding reception, and the room was filled with tables and chairs and floral decorations. And I called up the guy who had just rented it. He hadn't carried his stuff off away. He'd rented the hall. And, of course, the chairs and tables they had to get from every which way. And I said, well, can you leave those things for 3 more days? We'll pay you if you'll just let us use it. And they said, fine. And they didn't even charge us. And so the Lord provided all of that for us. And so we were just so thankful to the Lord for that. Well, when I had left for South Africa, well, while I was in South Africa, I had to buy all the supplies for the conference. And I bought 86 complete setups, trays, tables, silverware, and so forth, to feed 86 people. And we were only expecting at that time 10 to 15, but we were thinking ahead to the future conferences. So I bought 86 complete sets. But when I left for South Africa, that was great because Carl Peterson told me when I left, we got 20 pastors signed up. And that's what we expected. Out of 20, maybe 10 or 15 will make it. And so that wasn't surprising a month before the conference. But then when I was leaving South Africa on my way back to Mozambique, I called him and I said, how many have we got? And he said, we got 54 signed up. Well, that's okay. We got 86 place settings. That'll work. Well, by the time I got to Nampula 10 days later and I called him up, he said, we got 137 people signed up. And I thought, oh, no. You know, we're never going to be able to do this. It's going to be a big failure. And what are we going to do? Well, when the day came for them to actually appear, they were coming from all over Mozambique, and though 137 signed up, said they were going to try to come, only 85 showed up, and we had 86 place settings. So we saw the hand of the Lord in that, and we had no idea how many guys were going to need a bed. We told them, you know, if you got friends, relatives, church contacts in Nampula, stay with them. But if you're really hard up, we'll work something out. And so we'd reserve 20 beds scouring around the different downtown boarding houses. And that night when the men all registered and the guys who didn't have a place to stay informed us they had to have a bed. We had 18 men that needed a bed. And our shot in the dark of 20 again turned out to be divinely led by the Lord. So we were just so thankful. That was our first conference 4 years ago, and we just saw the Lord undertaking all the way through that. And it has been a really exciting ministry for us to be involved in. As I've mentioned, we've had in subsequent conferences up to 160 church workers coming from 8 of Mozambique's 10 provinces, representing 43 different denominations and church works. And we've sold thousands of books at each of these conferences, which are otherwise are not even available in Mozambique. And because that's one of the big draws for the conference, the opportunity to get your hands on Christian literature, we've always said we're going to do our best to get a permanent bookshop going in Mozambique, in Nampula, and we did. We just opened it the past year, and we now do have a Christian bookshop. And what's really exciting to me about this is that in all those years when I was working in the formerly Catholic Hospital of Marere, and we had these wonderful opportunities, 150 people gathered together in the main hall hearing the gospel presentation every Sunday afternoon, and we would always give them gospel portions afterwards, and we'd tell them, you've got to know about Jesus Christ in order that you might have faith in Him, in order that you might cry out to Him, in order that you might be saved. And this is where you learn about Jesus Christ. And then we would give them gospel portions. And I'd make rounds afterwards, and they'd all be in their beds really trying to understand what these scripture portions were telling them in the gospel handouts that we would give them. But I knew that when they left the hospital, they were going to go find, if the Lord directed them, they would try to find the nearest church available that they could participate with. And again, was very much concerned that once they came into those churches, what they would be hearing is salvation by trying to be good enough, by obeying the church rules. And I just wanted, and others, of course, it's a predominantly Catholic country still relative to the Protestant church. And, of course, because this was a former Catholic hospital, I figured a lot of them would make a beeline for a Catholic cathedral in order to hear more of what they were learning in the hospital. And so that always was a concern, to be involved in evangelism, which we wanted to do, of course, but not having any means of follow-up. Well, I just consider it to be a wonderful provision of the Lord. Not only is He providing for this hospital to be built that will be a tremendous evangelistic tool in Nampula, but here, of the whole country of Mozambique, He's made Nampula the headquarters, the center for these annual pastors' conferences. And about half of the pastors who come to the conference are from the Nampula province. And we are seeing that these literature distribution, excellent books that are being put into their hands, these wonderful conferences, we bring in speakers from all over the world to address these men. And I'm so thankful that over time, I believe we're going to have congregations springing up throughout Nampula that we can refer people to hear more about the gospel of salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. So I see these two ministries as dovetailing together by the grace of God. And we see the hand of the Lord, I believe, evident all over both of these ministries. So we're very grateful for all of that. I think I've got a fair bit of time. Now, that was the end of the report from last night. Since I'm not obviously going to be able to deal with Acts chapter 9, verses 15 and 16, I thought I would spend some time just sharing some more of the stories from our experiences in Mozambique during the early years when it was so difficult. I've got one story here from later years. I don't know if we'll get to that. Please excuse me. I'll probably read some of these newsletters just because we'll go faster that way. But if you're interested, at the back of the room, I've got on the back table pictorial evangel. Basically, it's the pictures you're going to see in a little bit. And then I've got several of our favorite stories from newsletters that are out on the back table. And if you're interested afterwards, there'll be a few copies, and you can pick up one if you're interested. But the first story I want to tell about is the second hospital attack. This is from November the 6th, 1991. Fear not thou. This is a word that the Lord spoke to Isaiah in Isaiah 41, verses 10 and 13. Fear not thou, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. For I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, Fear not, I will help thee. Well, it was over 10 years ago, and of course at this time that would be 23 years ago. It was over 23 years ago that one of our good friends, Betty Rich, first brought my attention to these verses. It was the Lord's promise to Israel as they passed through difficult days. What an encouragement it must have been for Isaiah to hear the omnipotent God say, Fear not, I will help thee. We don't hear the voice of God as Isaiah did, but if actions speak louder than words, then surely there are times when God thunders this very truth in our own ears. For us, October 12th, ironically the birthday of Betty Rich, for us, October 12th, 1991 was one of those times. That morning I headed out to Marere as usual, stopping by the city health headquarters to pick up a truckload of nurses and technicians that needed transportation to the hospital. The first indication that things were not right came as we headed out of town, and we encountered the usual traffic on the way to Marere, only today the vehicles were returning from the hospital, still laden with all their workers. At the turnoff to the dirt road that winds up the hill to the hospital, local people were restlessly milling about. They stopped the car to warn us that there had been an attack at the hospital just 2 hours earlier. Renamo guerrillas had raided the hospital, equipment had been destroyed, patients had died. We hurried on to the hospital. Finding out quickly who and what had been hurt seemed more bearable than the suspense of not knowing, even though it would have been safer to stay where we were. As we entered the hospital, signs of the attack were everywhere. Windows were shattered, halls, offices, and wards were strewn with the debris of overturned and broken equipment. There wasn't a locked door downstairs that hadn't been broken down as the guerrillas ransacked the building. The premises were still mostly abandoned. Few of the patients had returned after their early morning flight into the bush. As I ran up the stairs to the surgical ward, I was amazed and relieved to find the storeroom for the Grace Missions and Kokamu supplies had been untouched. Kokamu was the Canadian organization that had refurbished the hospital. After the raid last 29 December, Kokamu had put a steel grate across this doorway of the storeroom, but it was incorrectly installed and it couldn't be locked. So you could just swing it open on its hinges. Behind the grate, the original door didn't even have a latch. It was held shut by a padlock and a hasp. The hasp was fastened to the door with only three little screws. You could have leaned against it and it would have fallen open. It was held shut with this padlock. Apparently the guerrillas didn't notice this since they left the door alone, though the presence of the only grate in the entire hospital clearly indicated it was a room of some importance. The medicine and other supplies within would have been worth far more than everything else they carried off combined. The treatment room at the entrance to the surgical ward was a mess. The door had been broken in and the cabinets ransacked. 5 feet away was the door to the surgical block, untouched. And, of course, right across the top of it, it said surgical block. The patients cowering on a nearby veranda said they'd heard the soldiers shouting to each other about getting into the surgical suite to carry off the equipment and the medicines there, which they badly needed in their base hospital just 60 kilometers away. According to the patients, they pounded the door again and again, but to no avail, though it's no stronger than other doors in the hospital. After examining the door later, I'm somewhat incredulous. Either God helped it in a remarkable way, or the panic-stricken patients were simply mistaken in their perceptions, because it wasn't even scarred. In any event, our thanks and praise to God for His deliverance is undiminished. It's remarkable that the guerrillas carried out so much destruction and yet completely missed the two most valuable areas of the hospital and the two areas in which Grace Missions has heavily invested. Truly, the Lord our God helps us. After checking out the patients who had trickled back to the wards, I headed off in search of the ones still hiding in the countryside. There were rumors that at least two surgical patients had died during the confusion. Indeed, the stories of the patients were amazing. Anywhere from 30 to 300 guerrilla soldiers, depending on who you talk to, came marching out of the bush at the first light of dawn. A few had rifles, and there was one bazooka. Most carried spears, machetes, bayonets, or bows and arrows. Now, the fellows with the spears and the bayonets and the bows and arrows, those are the Sagaya warriors. Now, that's fascinating stories. On one of the subsequent attacks, they actually managed to kidnap. They corralled and kidnapped the nurses who were on duty. They were always after them as well, but they would run away. But this time they got caught, and they carried them off. And in the course of spending 6 weeks in the base hospital of the guerrillas before they escaped, they learned all kinds of things. And during the attack, in fact, they discovered all sorts of interesting stories. And I'm not going to detour to tell you about the Sagaya warriors, but it's pretty amazing. These are guys who work through the power of voodoo. And so, well, I'll tell you one thing. Well, a couple of things. I'll go ahead and tell the stories. They go through a big initiation ceremony. First of all, these guys are not allowed to use anything but traditional African weapons. And you can always recognize a Sagaya warrior because he comes into the clinic with his quiver. And inside the quiver, he's got all these spears, these lances that he throws with deadly accuracy. Now, these are just like bows and arrows, or like arrows. And he throws them, and they just create a superficial wound. But they're tipped with venom that's supposed to kill people. And on one occasion, they brought a guy in who'd been run down by these Sagaya warriors, and they lanced him with their lances. And then they just walked up after he fell on the floor, pulled out their lances, and headed off, expecting him to die. But he didn't die. And so I don't know how often that venom really works, but we didn't have to do much for that fellow. But in addition to using their poison arrows, they go through an initiation ceremony that's conducted by the witch doctor, in which their spell is cast upon them that makes them invulnerable to metal objects. Bullets can't go through their body. They can't be knifed or speared or anything like that with a metal object. And at the end of the ceremony, the witch doctor takes a machete, and he comes up to each one of them, and he hits them right on the chest with the blade of the machete, and it knocks them on the ground. But it doesn't leave a cut. And so they're convinced that they're invincible. But even more important than their own conviction that they are indestructible, at least to metal, they're also, everybody else is convinced that's the case. And it doesn't make any difference who you talk to. You can go up to the most educated people in Mozambique, the governor, I suppose. Everybody I've talked to, they insist that this is so. And anyway, so the Sagaya warriors participate in these raids. And when they kidnapped the nurses and they were running off with them, after a while, the local militia grouped itself together. They grabbed their AK-47s, and then they headed off in the bush after these guys who were having to go slow because they had the population at knife point and gun point carrying all the loot that they'd stolen from the hospital. So they were going slow. The militia was going fast. Well, the militia began to get up where they could see the guys who were fleeing with the nurses and with the hospital's plunder. And when the Renamu guerrillas saw the Frelimo militia coming up with their AK-47s, they just sat on the ground And they said to the Sagaya warriors, go get them. And the Sagaya warriors then headed off in the direction of the bullets with their spears and so forth. And as soon as the Renamo guerrillas, or as soon as the Frelimo, the government forces, saw the Sagaya warriors coming, they turned around and ran the other way. And I don't know if it's true that an AK-47 can't hurt a Sagaya warrior, but it's sure not going to do any damage when it's pointed the other way, which is always the case when they see the Sagaya warriors coming. So anyway, those are some of the stories about the Sagaya warriors. Well, so anyway, most of them carried spears, machetes, bayonets, or bows and arrows. Upon reaching the hospital, they began firing the rifles into the air. Pandemonium broke out as patients awoke to the fearful sounds of an attack. Everyone who could do so fled. One man who had just had an emergency operation 3 days before to remove gangrenous bowel pulled out all of his tubes, catheters, and IVs, dashed from the building. And though he was making an excellent recovery, he had hardly moved a muscle since his operation. He was frightened by all of these contraptions hanging off of his body. Well, as he fled across the field in front of the hospital, patients were on either side of him, patients were behind him. They saw him just churning away with adrenaline pumping through his veins along with everybody else. And then suddenly he just pitched over and fell on the ground and didn't get up again. And they thought he had been shot. When we examined him, there were no bullet wounds at all. Most likely he was the victim of a pulmonary embolus, which is a rare postoperative complication that could easily have evolved under that set of circumstances. Well, another patient, this one a frail old man, had just undergone major abdominal surgery the day before. He was an old, feeble guy. He arrived at the hospital significantly anemic, and this was aggravated by a greatly prolonged operation with constant oozing of blood. He ended up after the operation with a hematocrit of only 21, which is about half the blood cells that a healthy American has supplying oxygen to his body. But in this state, he scrambled out of his bed one day after major abdominal surgery with half the blood cells in his body. He leaped from his bed. He ran down this long hallway to the end of the second floor surgical block, out on the veranda, jumped off the wall, jumped over the wall of the veranda, down onto the first story roof of the building below, ran across that roof, jumped down onto the floor, ran across the courtyard of the hospital, out through the gates, and he didn't stop running for I don't know how long. Well, I finally caught up with him about 2 hours after all of this. The guy was still breathless. Well, one wonders, fear is a powerful stimulus, and one wonders what might be accomplished for good if we only feared the right things. The Lord said, be not afraid of them that kill the body, and after that have no more they can do. But I will forewarn you whom ye shall fear. Fear him that after he hath killed hath power to cast into hell. That's Luke 12:4-5. By the fear of the Lord men depart from evil. Proverbs 16:6. Well, patients who couldn't flee sought hiding places wherever they could. One debilitated TB patient managed to conceal himself atop a wardrobe where he remained unnoticed, but from which vantage point he had a clear look at the guerrillas as they ransacked everything in their path working through the hospital. They took everything, the dishes, the food, the water pitchers, even the torn-up pajamas and clothing of the peasant patients. But thankfully, Renamo has recently altered its strategy in carrying out such raids. A few years ago, they simply would have shot all of the patients in their bed. We read of accounts like that happening in the southern part of Mozambique as part of their terrorism campaign. But now that Mozambique is moving to free, open elections in which Renamo will be allowed to participate as a legitimate party, they can't afford to continue such tactics. And in this attack, many of the soldiers were scrupulously polite and reassuring to the patients as they robbed them and the hospital, telling them that they wished them no harm. And indeed, when the dust settled, the only death was that of the one surgical patient. Well, nevertheless, the experience was unnerving. All but two of my patients pleaded to be discharged, leaving the ward almost empty. As part of their propaganda to undermine the use of the hospital, the soldiers left a photo of the Renamo leader with the message that they would be back to finish the job. Well, taking the hint, I showed up later that night in order to fix the faulty grate at the back room and to move all of our supplies from the surgical block into that room. But when I finally finished the job, it was pitch dark. There was no electricity due to other guerrilla attacks on the power lines bringing electricity to our district. We spent most of the time without power, it seemed like, during those early years. The two women, left alone on the night shift, didn't even have a candle or a kerosene lamp. They clung to each other in the darkness. No government soldiers had been stationed at the hospital to protect it, even in the face of such an obvious threat. The two nurses dejectedly asked why they just sat there waiting to be kidnapped. And I shared their frustration when I returned to the darkened city and saw, as usual, all the clubs and the bars lit up. When external power is cut off, the city fires up its own small generator to furnish electricity to the vital organs of Nampula, which for some reason consist of all the local night spots, but not the hospitals, not the schools, not the orphanage, certainly not the churches. The God of this world has his little day, does he not? But the God we serve is greater, and we've seen that yet again in this gracious deliverance from Satan and his minions. Truly, they can go no further than God permits. Ye are of God, little children, and have overcome them already, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. 1 John 4, verse 4. I want to press ahead to another story. I'm going to skip this one. This story is Answers to Little Prayers. Answers to Little Prayers. August 3rd, 1992. The first month has seen a lot of changes here in Nampula. One Friday night, 3 weeks ago, I mentioned to Julie how different life was this year compared to last. We marveled how the availability of electricity and running water could produce such a change in lifestyle. Ironically, it was that very night that Renamu attacked the power line supplying electricity to northern Mozambique. When we woke up the next morning, we were back in the 19th century again. No power, no running water. This time, besides blowing up the power stanchions near the hydroelectric plant hundreds of miles from here, Renamu sent a separate band of guerrillas to cut off the flow of emergency power that trickles in from the port city of Nacala during such crises. And thus, in one night, the city was completely cut off from external power. Without electricity, not a drop of water was pumped for days. Clearly, the guerrillas are perfecting their ability to strangle Nampula and northern Mozambique. So we braced ourselves for another long siege without regular electricity or running water. And then it goes on through the difficulties that this creates. However, once again, God has brought such spiritual blessing from the present hardship we can identify with Paul's word in 2 Corinthians 12:10. I take pleasure in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am strong, and for when I am weak, then am I strong. It's when our own resources run out that we begin to see the mighty hand of the Lord taking over. And we did receive a lot of help in various ways from the Lord to get us through this difficult time. But the greatest excitement this time is what Kent, our little three-year-old, he's now 14, has been learning as current difficulties have driven even him to his little knees. At his birth, a retired couple enrolled Kent in the Bible Memory Association program, and it's been a wonderful gift. For over a year, we've been reading the first book to him. It's an acrostic of 26 different Bible verses, each one starting with a different letter of the alphabet. And on this particular occasion, we were happening to look at both the L verse and the I verse, one beside the other. And the L verse is, "Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is none else." Isaiah 45:22, and there's a picture of a little girl looking up to heaven, and for all the world, it looks like she's looking at God. And I asked Kent, 3 years old, I said, "Do you suppose she can see God?" And he said, "Yeah," and because it looked like she was surely looking at something. I said, "No, we can't see God because he doesn't have a body. He's a spirit. He's invisible. So how do you suppose we know he's there?" And I was thinking of the I verse, and he didn't have a clue. How do we know he's there if we can't see him? And so then I read the I verse, "If ye shall ask anything in my name, I will do it." John 14:14. Well, I was just having little devotions with him. I didn't know what I was getting into. But even a little three-year-old is keenly aware of the difference electricity makes in life. And as I read that verse, John 14:14, "If ye shall ask anything in my name, I will do it," something must have clicked in Kent's three-year-old head, because he suddenly burst forth with his first spontaneous prayer request. "I know how to solve this problem. I'll just pray to the Lord to give us electricity so Mommy can cook tomorrow." Well, at that point, we were already 9 days into the outage, and we went through two episodes where we went 6 months at a time, both times without any electricity. And here we were 9 days into this outage, and there hadn't been even one flicker of power. And for a moment, I thought we ought to back away from this showdown that was developing. After all, even though Julie doesn't bake when there isn't electricity, she can still cook on the kerosene cooker outside on the veranda. And God had granted that we entered this trial with four full tanks of gas, which she could use on a little gas stove we had. So I thought about cautioning against frivolous requests or explaining the nuances of the expression "in my name." Just exactly what does that mean to pray in Jesus' name? You don't just ask for whatever you want to, you ask for what He wants. However, I knew none of that would be understood by a three-year-old and decided we just have to let Kent pray for electricity and then leave it to God to back His promise in a way a three-year-old could understand. So Kent prayed then and there that God would give Mommy electricity tomorrow so she could cook the next day. Well, as you can imagine, Mommy and Daddy also did some praying as well. And God was faithful. The next day, we went all the way through the day, no electricity. Got to be 6 o'clock at night, which is pitch dark over there next to the equator. And everything was totally dark. And then all at once, all over the city, the lights came on. And as happens in Mozambique, the people came pouring out of their houses and out of their apartments, and they start chanting, "Energia, energia, electricity." And one of those who poured out of our house was Kent, you know, with all the others dancing and singing, "Energia, energia." And we called him inside and reminded him how he had prayed for electricity and how God had been present and heard, even though Kent could not see him. Well, the effect was dramatic. The thought that all of this excitement and all of this celebration all over the city was the result of his prayer was absolutely overwhelming. What awesome power he had discovered. It was as if he personally had produced all the electricity the city was now enjoying. Well, after that, there was no stopping Kent from praying. When a problem arose, his first suggestion was to pray. And a short time later, he lost Mommy's measuring tape that he'd been playing with it. And after they'd searched for it all over the house to no avail, he said, "Well, we just need to ask God for another measuring tape." And I think we've all been through this many times. He was properly impressed, as God gave the same one back again when Julie found it just moments after the prayer. Hunted for 15, 20 minutes without any success. Prayed, and immediately there it was, the next place that they looked. Well, later the same week, we gave Kent a broken flashlight. Now, Mommy and Daddy each have our own flashlight, which we use to make our way around the house in the darkness. And we gave him a flashlight. It was broken. It didn't work, but it made him feel very important to have a flashlight of his own. But he had lost it, and it seems we're always searching for things that he misplaces. Often he leaves items on the common veranda where they're promptly carried off by the neighbors and never seen by us again. And this, of course, does not make us happy. Well, this was another occasion when Kent had been playing with his toy on the veranda, and when the flashlight didn't turn up anywhere in the house after we turned the place upside down, Julie was sure, and I also, that it had disappeared in the black hole outside our front door. Well, after a while, Kent suggested that they ask God to help them find it. And Julie grumbled that God wasn't going to help him this time. And Kent came to me without having any success with her. And I said, "Well, you can pray if you want to, but God probably won't answer your prayer because He wants you to learn to be responsible." Well, that didn't dissuade Kent at all. He bowed his head and he prayed out loud. But Julie and I were through looking. And not getting any support from us, after he prayed, Kent headed dejectedly to the sofa and just flopped himself down on the sofa because Mom and Dad weren't going to keep looking. Well, whenever he flops him down himself on the sofa, he always did this. This is the way he does it. He lies down on the sofa and he sticks his hand down in the crack between the cushions. And he flopped himself down on the sofa and stuck his hand down in the crack between the cushions. And what should his hand hit but his flashlight? And so immediately he leaped up, waving the flashlight overhead. But the glow on his face would have rendered any flashlight superfluous. His excitement was far beyond what is normal when he finds some lost object. What lit his face this time was the thrill that never ceases to excite us. The joy and the amazement of realizing that God is there. And He heard my prayer. And He answered. Well, like many a Christian parent before us, Julie and I were moved that God would manifest Himself to our child in so personal a way. It's hard to believe the Creator of heaven and earth would concern Himself with the prayers of a three-year-old. But then, why should God hear the prayers of any man? The greatest ruler to walk this planet with all of his pomp and show still falls infinitely short of the glory of God. He is like the grass, which sprouts today and withers tomorrow. At his zenith, the difference between him and a helpless baby becomes insignificant when compared to the gulf that separates them both from the majesty and the glory of God. In his conceit, Pharaoh said, "Who is God that I should listen to him?" As is so often true of the natural man, he had it turned completely around. The real question is, who is man that God should listen to us? Yet he hears the voice of his children. It's a reality we can never get over. And when we behold him stooping even lower, hearkening to the artless prayers even of his children's children, our wonder and gratitude grows ever greater. So that's answers to little prayers.